The Big Picture, brought to you by Bible Society Australia, shining the light of God's Word into every corner of your world. And Sydney's Hope 103.2, there's always hope. The Big Picture, a Christian insight on the world of film, television and popular culture, with magazine editor Ben McKechin and scriptwriter Mark Hadley.
Hello, I'm Ben McKechin.
And I'm Mark Hadley.
Now, today on The Big Picture, March 16, we're going to be talking about Big Eyes, the latest film from Tim Burton.
We'll also be looking at our top five action films.
And we're going to go into the dystopian near future again with the latest blockbuster for teens, Insurgent. Man, it's so good to have a theme song, isn't it, Mark? So good to have a theme song.
It always be, I don't know, if I could actually have that playing during my life, as I was walking around my house, I'd feel a lot cooler anyway.
Oh, man, I feel cooler instantly. Now we're up to episode 3 of The Big Picture. How do you feel?
So far, I'm pretty happy with 1 and 2.
Good. And some of the reports we've had back from people is that they feel the same. I appreciate, too, that there's been some fact checkers out there that picked me up on calling the Lord of the Rings sequel the Twin Towers instead of the Two Towers. We love that kind of discernment and engagement from those who are participating in The Big Picture. Keep that coming, because that's what The Big Picture is all about, is the Christian perspective on movies and TV and pop culture, where we dive into the deeper things of all this stuff and discern and engage, et cetera, which is what we're about to do now. As we talk about what's showing on TV now, Mark, you're going to talk to us about, and I can't believe we're doing this in 2015, but you're going to talk to us about reality TV because it's still going. Reality TV is still going, and not only just going, it's exceedingly popular still, with shows like My Kitchen Rules and The Block dominating the airwaves on our TVs at the moment.
We've travelled to every corner of Australia in search of them. From every country town to the finest establishments.
I can't believe we're going to be the first to cook on MKR. We were both born and bred in Mount Isa.
We've entered My Kitchen Rules to put Mount Isa on the map.
I think it's about time somebody brought some class to this competition.
We're best friends from Melbourne.
It's the Paris of the South.
Food's up, guys. Grab a plate, get whatever you like.
We love everything French. We love the food, we love the wine.
That Dauphin Noir. It's to die for.
I'm all kitchen appliance demonstrator.
This replaces over 10 kitchen appliances, so it's your blender, your food processor, your mixmaster, your bread maker, just to name a few.
Oh, our social calendar is absolutely brimming.
Anytime we've got something special on, Jack decks us out, and then we head straight out for cocktails.
One half of the year it's polo, second half it's the races.
We usually go to the members.
It's a bit exclusive.
There really is just a fence. Segregating the bogans.
Wowzers, what have we come into here?
My Kitchen Rules is probably like the premier version of reality television today on Australian TV. And it is, in fact, one of those sort of situations that has emerged from, like you say, a runaway style of TV.
How long has it been going now? Like more than a decade, hasn't
it?
Look, reality, this brand of reality TV.
I think, reality TV really had its sort of big kickoff with Big Brother.
Yeah. And Survivor.
And Survivor. And after that, what we actually had was a series of cameras being prodded into almost any normal situation, quote unquote, that you could have and have people sort of observed with their natural reactions. And that's the idea. I mean, from a TV producer's perspective, reality television is absolutely golden because you don't have to pay all those nasty residuals to actors. You don't have to have scriptwriters working day and night to actually get things done. And, you know, even special effects are pretty much dropped down to a kitchen cabinet. You know, so there's not much that really has to go into the production side of it, apart from the organising.
Yeah. So what makes My Kitchen Rules so good then?
Well, My Kitchen...
Or premier. You use the word premier. Why?
Because basically it is... when I say premier, I say leading in the ratings. That's basically what I'm
right.
I don't want to say that this is my...
with quality.
Yeah, I don't want to say this is my favourite style.
Well, I really sounded like you were.
Well, I'm going to take that back right now. That would be a half-baked idea.
Okay. Oh!
Dad joke, first one for the show.
Yeah.
Okay, so what basically you have with this is the sort of perfect combination of something we can all relate to. So we all have to cook, or we all have to shop, we all have to get things ready. And then something we also have to struggle with against time frames. And then what they throw in to increase the tension is less and less about the cooking. I mean, if you like, MasterChef was the show that was very much about the cooking. Let's have a look at the recipes and let's see what we're doing. What amazing things can we make? And now it's all about the personality. So you pick up on our sound grab. It's very much about constructing a show now with people who will just explode in the kitchen. You know, we're looking for the burnt souffle. We're not actually looking for one that works out and is...
And is that still perfect. Pretty much the recipe across the board for all of reality TV? So in the intro, we mentioned The Block. I think there's other shows. Isn't there one about celebrities and Get Me Out of Here or something like that? Isn't that quote-unquote reality TV? But is that the basic recipe that we're looking for? Explosive people doing stuff.
Yeah, and that's right. And so in Channel 7 this year, we'll actually be bringing out a combination of all forms.
Please,
of,
yes. of reality and it's TV. Called what?
Well, this is Kitchen Revolution. So what we do is...
Please go on.
Yes, we bring in a small party from South America. No, actually, it's not that. What we do is we take basically two programs. We take our building style program, we take our kitchen style program, and we take our restaurant launching programs. There's a third, and we put them all in the same one.
Is this going to stop this year, or is there way more than that to come? More than Kitchen Revolution?
It's actually going to go downhill this year. Okay, so basically,
just this year,
just this year. Channel 10 is.
Didn't you see Big Brother the last couple of seasons?
Well, thankfully, Channel 9 has, after a couple of seasons, realized that that was a bit of a mistake. It only took Channel 10 about 10 seasons to realize that. But and so it won't be doing Big Brother again until, well, maybe until the coffers are dry and they're going to give it another go. Maybe until somebody builds another house on the Gold Coast. But look, basically, what we're going to have now is, I guess, something that's going to make Big Brother look kind of entertaining. You know, we have Channel 10 is going to kick off with a British format called Gogglebox, which is, I kid you not, a reality TV show about watching people watch their televisions and seeing how they react.
Okay.
Yeah, I know. If you're not actually getting all of that, let me just say it again. We're going to watch people watch TV.
Yawn. Okay. So, right. So this shows no reality TV as a trend on TV, shows no signs of stopping. Why do people keep watching them? So My Kitchen Rules and The Block, as much as we can jest and poke fun of them, it seems like both of us aren't big fans of these shows, but plenty of people are. Why? Why do they keep tuning in?
Look, I have a couple of theories about this only because I can't understand it. And from a scriptwriter and producer's point of view, I can tell you why the TV stations do it. Because it makes good sense and it's returned.
Yeah, you mentioned that. So it's cost effective and easy to put out.
Why do we watch it?
Yep.
Well, look, one of the reasons I think is because we're increasingly disconnected. So in terms of society, we've started building houses that are surrounded by 10-foot fences now rather than 4-foot fences. Okay, we've got houses that face inwards rather than outwards. I mean, just architecturally speaking, we have entertainment rooms where we used to have entertainment areas outside. Okay, we are really becoming a society that doesn't want to know its neighbours. Yet at the same time, we're social people, so we really do want to connect. Part of the problem is, though, that we are connecting with just something that's really artificial. And so from a Christian point of view, I'm really amazed about this because, you know, the Bible's quite clear. It's not good for man to be alone. That's true. We really are social people. We should be relating. And yet at the same time, we've got this sort of falsity. You look at many levels of society now, whether it be the false friends, sorry, everybody on Facebook, but you know, whether it be the sort of people who
they're
are
all
just,
real, Mark. They're all true.
Those 4,000 people care, okay? I just want to say about me personally. Look, there really are connections, but we've given them the misnomer of friends, and we've downgraded friends in the process. And our connections in society in terms of we're actually finding out about our world and feeling like we're connected to people because we're in their lives 24/7 or we're watching them explode. But there's one other thing. We love as a race to see people fall down because it lifts us up. And so when we watch...
lowest common denominator, isn't it? Which I'm part of. I love those. You know, like Wipeout, that show where people get like wiped out. I think it's hilarious.
Or Celebrity Splash, which is the big failure for last year. We just love people to fail high diving as opposed to making a good entry. Look, the real tragedy of this is going to be finally culminating with Channel 9 this year when they do Married at First Sight. You know, the idea of bringing a bunch of contestants as if we did not need... marriage to be dropped even lower in the estimation of society, what we're going to have now is a show that actually turns it into a prank for a reality television. So we are disconnected. We need to be seriously connected. And so if there was ever a time where you hear a television producer like myself say, turn the TV off, it would be reality TV.
Right. And that's the Now Showing on TV segment for this week. Turn your TV off.
Okay, we'll bring this up into our next segment this week. We actually have... Oh, damn it. This is what happens when my screen goes blank. I love the sort of stuff that actually helps me.
One technology, Mark. One technology. Weren't you going to ask me about what's showing at cinemas this week, I believe?
I'm glad you brought me up to where I should be.
We talked about this beforehand.
Okay. Coming up in cinemas this week, we actually have a fairly important release. Why don't you give us a bit of an idea about what Tim Burton's been doing lately?
Well, before I do that, let's hear a bit from the film itself.
You're going to love this stuff.
Why are their eyes so big?
The eyes are the windows of the soul.
That's why I paint them so big. I've always done it that way.
Why are you lying?
Sadly, people don't buy lady art.
The painting says keen.
I'm keen. You're keen.
Smile.
We're sold out.
They adore you, big eyes.
He sells paintings, and he sells pictures of the paintings, and he sells postcards of pictures of the paintings.
Good God, it's a movement.
So, are you flipping for all this?
Honestly, I can't believe I live here.
I remember when Mama painted that.
You're confused. I painted that.
Tim Burton, I think, is a director's name that most people know. Even people who don't necessarily run out to the cinema every week would have heard of Tim Burton. I think it definitely would have seen Tim Burton films. Everything from Beetlejuice and Edward Scissorhands right through to, sadly, the Planet of the Apes remake that happened a couple of years ago.
Everybody's allowed one.
That's okay. Right. Sleepy Hollow or The Nightmare Before Christmas, that kind of thing. The first Batman movie, way before Christopher Nolan. Tim Burton is a guy who's very noticeable in terms of the way his movies look and feel. He's got a real kind of gothic grandeur to the movies that he presents usually. This movie, though, Big Eyes, that's now showing at cinemas, is a little bit different from Tim Burton in a number of ways. It doesn't have the strong visuals that you'd expect of a Tim Burton film, and even the feel where he often dives into this kind of dark melancholy. The subject matter itself is quite dark, but it for want of a better expression, he actually plays a straight bat in this movie, which is, for anyone who's a big Tim Burton fan, I'm among them, it's quite a surprise to see him treat this story as straight as he does.
So give us an idea of the story to kick off. I mean, do we have characters in crazy makeup and sort of wiry hair?
Well, no, you don't. And I'm sure that's just conjured images of all the different movies that Johnny Depp particularly has made with Tim Burton. And he made like the Willy Wonka remake a couple of years ago. And Tim Burton is this like wonderful, fantastical, nightmarish world kind of guy. Big Eyes is set in a nightmarish, fantastical world, but based on a true story that happened in the 50s and 60s of an artist called Margaret Keane. She made these enormously popular paintings, particularly of children with really large eyes, these really sad, mournful eyes. You've probably seen these images around. But her work was published under the name of Keane, her surname. What she discovered after a number of years is that her second husband, Walter, was actually passing them off as his own. So he was claiming that he was the artist, and then she ended up participating in the lie. He'd convinced her that no one was going to buy lady art, and instead he became the front man for this artwork. And so Big Eyes pretty much charts the them getting together, their relationship, and the fallout that happens when Margaret really starts questioning what's going on here. Amy Adams plays Margaret, Christoph Waltz plays Walter Keane. They're great on screen together. There's a number of other people that show up in heaps of other Tim Burton movies. But yeah, I was really quite struck by how straight Tim Burton approached this.
Well, one of the things about Tim Burton is he creates these sort of weird characters.
Yeah.
But still manages to find empathy inside of them for us. So you take Edward Scissorhands, for example. You can't get something stranger than that. And yet at the same time, the empathy... do we get that empathy out of these characters?
Yeah,
it sounds like a very destructive marriage.
Do you do, yeah, it definitely is. And as much as it's a fraud film, like it's quite a fascinating case, really, particularly of how well Walter Keane was able to propagate this lie. And even it was before Andy Warhol in terms of the mass production of art, producing of art. One of the subtexts of this movie, one of the other themes in it, is where art meets commerce, and just this being a turning point where art actually became massively popular. And as much as critics railed against it and said it was terrible, Walter Keane made and Margaret Keane made loads of money out of mass producing their art. So that's going on, as well as this fraud story of how did he get away with it. But at the heart of it is this remarkably destructive marriage, and particularly this domineering husband and this wife that you do feel empathy for her. You actually feel some for him as well, which is quite strange, largely because he's just so deluded and so kind of over the top, and he just seems to be existing in his own world. He's actually believing his lie the longer it goes along. You can feel some empathy for him. I think Tim Burton wants us to do that, but he doesn't make us feel it as strongly as, say, a movie like Edward Scissorhands, which in the studio today we have the poster conveniently located just behind my shoulder to reinforce that. That was a movie I think you felt more of the empathy for the dark side. Tim Burton really likes to bring you in to the darkness and say it's actually not all doom and gloom. There's really something to like about Misfits.
Well, Willy Wonka's like that too. His version of Willy Wonka has this whole sort of character you really struggle to feel comfortable around, but then you realise in the end he's quite lovable.
Yeah, so it's difficult to feel comfortable around Walter Keane because he's just such a destructive liar. But one of the straight elements of this story, one of the things I didn't quite like about Big Eyes, is that the subject matter, Tim Burton obviously wants the story to tell itself, and he doesn't want himself to get in the way and all the usual trappings of his movies he hasn't put to the fore. That's a good thing. But Tim Burton also kind of heightens reality in as much as you're watching something that you know is a movie, you know is a story about a story. And as a result, particularly Christoph Waltz's performance as Walter, while it's really good, it's still a performance. And Walter Keane must have been a performer, but it can be difficult to really resonate with a movie as deeply that these are real people because you know you're watching performance.
Yeah, that's that weird thing when you actually no, it's supposed to be a factual story, but even you can't believe that you're watching a factual story.
And it does actually unfold like a movie as well, which isn't really the fault of the true life story. It just unfolds a bit like a movie.
So, look, from a Christian point of view, we're actually looking at a topic we have a lot to say about, because it's not, I mean, sure, we can say something about fraud.
And art. Berets.
What Christians have done with stained glass windows.
My goodness. Stained glass window segment. Please continue.
That'll be an idea for the next show. What I actually have in mind, though, is the idea of marriage. Okay, we refer to it as a Christian institution. And some people would say that this is a particularly Christian view of marriage. There you go. You've got the
presentation in Big Eyes.
Yeah, you've got the guy who is dominant in the relationship. You've got him telling the woman what she's got to do, her submitting to that, and basically all the chaos that follows. And it sort of sets you up for a sort of a criticism of the traditional model of marriage. Do you feel like that's a fair reflection?
Well, it's a fair reflection of what some people think Christian marriage is like. When they hear words like submission, they instantly think domination and that the man must be doing what Walter Keane is doing to Margaret Keane, which is basically just diminishing this woman beyond belief and trapping her, not just in a lie, but in this kind of domestic violence situation of mental abuse. Yeah, sadly, some people do think that's a portrait of Christian marriage, but I'd be arguing, well, either they haven't seen a Christian marriage in operation as it should be, and they definitely haven't read words in the Bible that describe Christian marriage. And so watching Big Eyes, I was thinking about there's passages in the book of Ephesians in the New Testament. In chapter 5, there's a really great summary of Christian marriage. And one of the lines out of chapter 5 reads
only,
as follows.
If only we had a Bible.
If only I had a Bible open in front of me.
Here's one.
To sum up, each one of you is to love his wife. This is talking to men. Each one of you is to love his wife as himself, and his wife is to respect her husband. Now, love and respect are in that sentence. They need much more unpacking. But the short story is that this reference to love, particularly for the husband, in comparison to what Walter Keane is doing, which is being a selfish, egotistical, destructive megalomaniac, the love that's described here in Ephesians chapter 5 is all about a husband sacrificing himself like Jesus Christ sacrificed himself for his followers. That's the model of love that's presented. So it's not saying go out and throw yourself under a bus for your wife unless she was going to get hit by one. It's
Again,
talking about
the... We'll step back from the construction of what might actually happen.
It's talking about the portrait of the level of love that you would go to, and it actually means putting your wife first rather than behind you. And that's what Big Eyes does not represent. As a Christian, a husband, that's a very difficult thing to do, to be less selfish than I am. But thank God that God's given us instruction to help us to do that, rather than movies like that, Big Eyes, which actually demonstrate to us the destructiveness that happens when men try to dominate women.
Yeah. And in fact, that would be something the Bible condemns. Well, look, that takes us out of, I think, our marriage counselling for the week.
Next week.
Next week we'll take on parenting.
In short, to sum up, now showing at cinemas, Big Eyes, it is worth a look. If you're a Tim Burton fan, I think you're going to enjoy it. You'll be slightly disappointed that he's playing a more straight bat than you expect, but the story's fascinating, the acting is great, and I really like the artwork.
Okay. And in fact, will you be getting the poster alongside your Edward Scissorhands copy?
Stay tuned.
Okay. Well, this week we're also going to return to a segment we kicked off about soundtracks in films. So I understand you're going to take us through soundtrack this week. What have you got in mind?
You understand correctly. This is our first musical interlude for the program this week. And we've actually decided, let's play some music from Tim Burton films. See what we did there? Talking about Big Eyes, now we're onto Tim Burton music. So
It was subtle right up until the point you pointed it out.
I don't know why I keep doing that. Tim Burton music. So we're going to play two songs. So the first one is from a movie that Tim Burton made a couple of years ago called Ed Wood.
First time, we are bringing you the full story of what happened. We are giving you all the evidence based only on the secret testimony of the miserable souls who survived this terrifying ordeal. The incidents, the places. My friend, we cannot keep this a secret any longer. Can your heart stand the shocking facts of the true story of Edward D. Wood, Jr.?
Oh, makes me want to go back and watch Ed Wood all over again. One of Tim Burton's earlier films, Ed Wood, was also a biopic, and it was this loving tribute to a director called Ed Wood, as in Edward Wood. And he is a bloke who's most famously credited for making what people describe often as the worst movie ever, which is the Plan 9 from Outer Space. I disagree with that. There are plenty of other worse movies. What Tim Burton picks up on in Ed Wood is a celebration of a guy who isn't that talented but really wants to be an artist. Why I chose that piece of music, though, it's a great summary, not just of the narrator speaks, not just a great summary of what the movie is, but the tone of the movie and the feel of the movie. And that's a great thing about music that's chosen in Tim Burton films, is that kind of spooky, eerie, cool, groovy collision of sounds that goes on. And one of the other notable things about that piece of music, which is called the main title from Ed Wood, is that it wasn't composed by Danny Elfman. So it was composed by Howard Shore, but Danny Elfman has done pretty much every Tim Burton movie, seemingly apart from this one. Danny Elfman, I think, is most famous for The Simpsons opening titles, but he also did heaps of Tim Burton music as well, which sounds a lot like that soundtrack also. But if you want to listen to great soundtracks, go back and raid those of Tim Burton movies. They're so evocative it hurts.
Okay, well, this week we kick off a new segment with Bible Society Australia's CEO and social commentator Greg Clark. And if actually you've been following the Bible Society, or for that matter Eternity, their national paper and the website, you'll know that Greg is a very sharp guy when it comes to observing all the sorts of things that bubble along underneath the surface and shape our society.
Very sharp.
Very sharp, and not afraid of taking on controversial topics. So he's actually going to have a look each week for us at a social topic that is basically forming the way we think,
We feel so as a nation. So big picture sprawls out from movies and TV further into popular culture.
Into all the sorts of things that make culture popular. So basically, this week, though, he's actually going to do, well, I guess makes it a little more serious than we normally would be. He's going to have a look at what the Bible has to say about the Royal Commission. And in a sense, the Royal Commission to child abuse is the sort of topic that you would actually think to yourself, well, you know, I'd actually like to think less about that if I could. But the truth is, how it's dealing with things is the way how we are going to see parenting and how we are going to see children and the way we relate in society. So what does the Bible have to say?
Let the little children come to me and do not hinder them, for the kingdom of heaven belongs to such as these. This verse from the Gospel of Matthew in chapter 19, verse 14, assures us that Jesus cared for children and even gave them special honour. But these wonderful words of Jesus are a source of sorrow in our culture at present. The Royal Commission into Institutional Responses to Child Sexual Abuse has made public the many horrific stories of incidents where children have been greatly hindered. It's no surprise to me that such deep and troubling sin makes some in our community suspicious of the Christian religion. But my prayer is that this suspicion can be overcome by genuine care and selfless service by Christian people. We want the genuine gospel of Jesus Christ to be believed and lived out for all to see its beauty, truth, and goodness. That's going to take a lot of repentance, courage, and humility. In today's Australia, the Christian message needs to be accompanied by the Christian lifestyle if we are to see the average Aussie feeling positive about Jesus' words, "Let the little children come to me." If we believe that the kingdom of heaven belongs to them, we will double our efforts to ensure that nothing hinders their pathway towards it.
That was Greg Clark from the Bible Society. He's going to be joining us every week, bringing us some reflections on what's going on in broader culture at the moment. Because as we said leading into that segment on the Royal Commission, he'll be hitting some serious topics some weeks, maybe some not so serious others. But what we're on about here at The Big Picture is opening up the Pandora's box of movies and TVs and everything else that's going on around us so we can think a lot more deeply about what's going on. Which leads us nicely into our next segment for the week, Mark. Press record. So we move from quite a very heavy subject, deep and worth listening to one also that, it's less heavy. I can't do a better segue than saying what we're going to do now is go to Press Record, which is our weekly segment where we hear from you, the people out there, you, the movie lovers, the TV lovers out there, where we get some reflection from you about the impact that the small and the big screen has had in your life. Mark, our intrepid reporter, this week went out and asked the big questions of some people. The big question this week being, what is the most memorable action movie moment of your life?
When I say action sequence, what sort of film springs to my surface of the mind?
Raiders of the Lost Ark. Indiana Jones, yeah. I'm actually thinking about the scene at the very start of Raiders of the Lost Ark when he goes into the cave and he comes out with all the snakes in the plane. I don't know if you remember, but it's pretty cool.
Remember, it's a classic.
The big boulder coming rolling out at him, yeah, and he dives into the plane and there's snakes and he hates snakes.
If you had a favourite action sequence out of all the films you've ever seen, what sort of action sequence would you remember?
My favourite one was definitely from The Blues Brothers, the car chase scene. That was epic. That was awesome.
Something a bit more, like, on the surface, really enjoyable popcorn movie is probably The Rock, yeah.
Transformers.
James Bond.
Is there one sequence that sticks out you always think of when you think of an action sequence?
I have a top two, both from The Dark Knight.
Batman, the Batman trilogy. I love the explosions. I especially love the one where the semi-trailer flips upside down.
Plus an action film. What do you actually... What comes to your mind?
Arnie.
Any Arnie. Any Arnie you've got. Any particular favourite?
It has to be the Terminator, yeah. Hasta la vista. I'll be back.
Don't you think that is possibly the most quoted line in film history?
I'm just impressed anyone gives it a go and they know they're being recorded. And they know it's never going to be as good, but they still go for it. No. Respect.
Because every time you say, I'll be back, everyone tries to slightly become Austrian. And they square their shoulders.
Yeah.
I don't know. People actually physically change their form when they try and say that. What about you? I must say, the number of people who said The Dark Knight every time I was going through recording those. But if I said to you, action sequence, what would you say?
Off the top of my head?
Yeah.
Transformers,
yeah. There was a young guy in there. And honestly, of all the people I talked to, he was the one guy who, under 18, went Transformers. And like a bunch of mates around him went, you know.
Yeah.
Obviously, they hadn't seen Star Wars yet.
If I had more time, I'd raid through the film critic's bag and you know, get the more esoteric choice and that sort of stuff. But I've got a real soft spot for Transformers, and the fact of giant robots bashing each other up on freeways at high speed is great, and almost makes up for all those other Michael Bay movies.
Not Pacific Rim.
So that was Press Record for this week, hearing from you, the people, about how movies and TV matter to you. But leads us nicely, Mark, into our next segment for this week, the top five list.
Yes, well, my top five list is my top five action films of all time.
Awesome.
So, guys, if you're planning a night...
Kapow!
Yeah, wacko. If you're planning a night, when would you going to sit down... Come on, it was a Batman reference.
Yep.
If you sit down and you think to yourself, okay, the guys are coming around, we're going to have a movie marathon, it's going to be action, action, action... What would I say you should include? Well, let's just assume, firstly, they haven't seen any of these. But then maybe, too, assume that all of these are so rewatchable that you'll have a great night. So let's kick it off with number five.
Five.
The obvious contender for any action film night. It would not be complete without Die Hard.
Oh,
you've got to have
why
Die
is
Hard.
That not at number one?
Okay, because I want to build. Okay, but Die okay. Hard is the... Let's get the obvious. Let's, as they say... Throw the fish on the floor or take the trash. I don't know what we're saying here.
Let's get back to Die
let's
Hard.
Let's get obvious. Die Hard, that 1988 classic, which actually spawned six films. In fact, there's one more coming. Bruce Willis has actually said that he can only save the world a half a dozen more times. And so he feels that he will actually be able to go through one more Die Hard before he retires. So that's actually in pre-production now. But who can forget John McClane, the hapless New York City cop who basically can't visit a building, a bank, an airline without something blowing up or terrorists turning up. You've got to... No wonder
every man's story.
Every time I go to the bank, for heaven's sake, put that automatic weapon down. My favourite scene, though, has to be the one where John wraps a fire hose around himself
mm-hmm.
at the top of the Nakamoto Plaza and 110% realism throws himself off in order to avoid an explosion. Smashes through one of those, you know, safety windows that can't be smashed through, you know, 10 floors down. And just when he feels like he's safe, the very thing that saved his life, the fire hose, then starts to drag him out the window. So
yeah.
Personally, number five, Die Hard, you can watch any time.
Great choice.
Which brings us to...
Four.
I think this film reinvented the whole idea of the action sequence fight. I'm talking about The Bourne Identity.
Oh,
the Bourne Identity basically took espionage and made it real again. We'd had decades of James...
Well, movie real, at least.
We had decades of James Bond swanning around with martinis, you know, and doing some little neat karate chops to people. But finally, when you come to The Bourne Identity, you have something that looks like you'd be really terrified of meeting this guy. You know, these are the sorts of people who actually are. License to Kill. And so my favourite scene has to be another big window breaker. I don't know if you remember the scene.
You love the windows breaking.
Yeah, when The Bourne Identity, when he finally finds his home in Paris and he's wandering around looking at his austere home and his collection of kitchen knives neatly placed, a guy smashes through the window, a former assassin.
Every man's story.
This happens again. This is why I don't cook with the windows open.
Yep.
Okay, so I sit there and I see them fight in a way that really makes this sort of stuff look realistic. And so I think that is not only my vote for number four best action sequence, but my best knife fight ever. And let's move on.
Your best knife fight ever. Okay, number three.
Another knife-related film.
Three.
Now, I thought that I would take a moment just to be a bit educational, okay?
Oh, yeah, Mark.
If you have not seen this film, and there's a good chance you might not have, go out and grab it. This is House of Flying Daggers. House of Flying Daggers is one of those fantastic Chinese produced action films.
Oh, Mark, promoting non-English speaking films.
I'm a man
Whoa,
of many
Whoa, the
talents.
Big picture. Going global.
This is why I blame myself for suddenly getting glasses on account of the fact that I've been reading too many subtitles. Yumu Zhang, though,
Don't
is the director.
Don't talk down to the subtitles.
I won't. They're brilliant. The Daggers is the best example I know of the beautiful Chinese action film. And anybody who's seen some Chinese action films knows what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
There's an incredibly choreographed nature to the action in Chinese films. And so when you have this sort
like
of
poetic
situation,
violence.
Yeah, yeah. Like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon is another classic. Hero is another classic. And in fact, people who know better about these things than me will quote The Raid and things like that. And that's okay.
Or movies that were made pre- 2000, yes. Like in the 90s, 80s, or 70s. Yes.
So what we actually have in House of Flying Daggers, though, Zhang basically creates He takes that to the nth degree. Every single scene could be frozen and hung on my wall at home. It is so artistic, the way he frames everything, that it's just beautiful. And so if you want to see a great example of beauty meets action, the bamboo fighting scene in House of Flying Daggers is just incredible.
Wow, Thinking Man's beautiful artistic action movie at number three. So number two is...
Two.
My top two were a real struggle, I've got to admit. You know, it depends.
You juked it out.
I know, when I sat there, I thought to myself, you know, how do I really feel? Because I'd probably watch these films once each a week. You know, But number two is The Matrix. There are just so many memorable action films and action sequences in The Matrix. Yeah. You've got Neo learning Kung Fu with Morpheus, you know, in this sort of surreal mental dojo.
Mental dojo.
You've got Morpheus's infiltration team fighting their way out of that abandoned building while they're stuck between walls. You know, I mean, that's incredible. But my favorite, of course, is probably everybody's. The rooftop fight between the agents and Neo. Trinity just happens to turn up in a helicopter with a minigun. You know, these are all the sorts of elements you really need in a good action sequence. And what guy has not at some point, I mean, forget the I'll be back line, attempted the half-lean back Neo stance with the bullet Neo flying everywhere. And no one can really do it, but everybody gives that a go just as much as they might do an arm.
Wow, so if that one lost the battle for number one spot on the list, what is number one?
One.
Coming in at number one, James Cameron's 1986 never-to-be-surpassed classic, Aliens.
Yeah, boy!
I gotta
say, Aliens, cracker!
Sigourney Weaver's Lieutenant Ripley has survived the Nostromo disaster. She's woken up at a deep space station just orbiting around Earth. And what does she think she's going to do? Why don't we go back to the planet again and find out if there's more than one alien?
Every woman's story.
This is true. You know, and really, Sigourney Weaver has just become the archetype for all female action heroes. You know, and so my best and probably longest running action sequence I've ever seen sits inside this James Cameron film. Ripley's ready to escape the planet because, as we all know, the whole LB-40 is going to blow up thanks to the nuclear reactor that's been built on
Everyone
the planet.
Everyone knows that.
Yes. And so Ripley's decided that she's going to leave the planet. They've just got the spaceship in time. No, she's got to go back because Newt's being captured. All right, where is she going to go? Well, she has to go into the heart of the reactor. What's in the heart of the reactor? Well, that happens to be the whole high of the alien species. What does she find when she finds Newt? Oh, well, it just happens to be the mother of all aliens, literally the queen of the aliens. Okay, it's time to leave. We get out just in time. And she blasts off into space. Everybody's happy. Is she happy? Well, Mum's not happy because the alien mother's been hanging on the back of the spaceship the entire time. And what follows is the best fight between what is ostensibly a 24th century pickup truck and an alien. You know, you see this fantastic moment. There's a line in there that everybody knows, which I can't use.
This is a family program.
It's a family program.
Even though we've been really talking up aliens as number one choice on the action movie list.
Duking it out. Alien Mother, Sigourney Weaver, Power Loaders. That is my favorite action film. And the reason why we're not going to play that now is because basically the problem with every action sequence is it's all sound effects. Whack, bang, crash. We went searching for the perfect action grab, and instead what we came up with, well, okay, here's a nod to all the fans of The Dark Knight. You really can't go back from the Joker and Heath Ledger.
You wanted me. Here I am.
I wanted to see what you'd do.
And you didn't disappoint. You let five people die. Then you let Dent take your place. Even to a guy like me, that's cold.
Where's Dent?
Those mob fools want you gone so they can get back to the way things were. But I know the truth. There's no going back. You've changed things. Forever.
And why do you want to kill me?
I don't want to kill you. What would I do without you?
That was a clip from The Dark Knight rounding off, getting an honourable mention at the end of our top five list for this week, top five action movies as chosen by Mark. Now it's time for the second musical interlude for our program today. So on soundtrack this week, we're focusing on Tim Burton's music. Earlier, we played something from the film Ed Wood. Now it's a choice from a movie he made a couple of years ago called Dark Shadows. The movie wasn't that great, but the soundtrack is a corker, including this most powery of ballads.
Thank you.
nights in white satin, never reaching the end. Letters I've written, never meaning to send. Beauty I'd always missed with these eyes before. Just what the truth is, I can't say anymore, 'cause I love you.
Yes, that's Nights in White Satin by the Moody Blues.
I'm laughing because, honestly, there's no track on earth that takes me back to the 70s quicker than Nights in White Satin. And, you know, and the whole angsty sort of sitting in your bedroom listening to the music and feeling like the world is... Yeah, I'm giving too much away.
Yeah, but that's one of the reasons I picked the movie, not so you could time travel back to your youth, Mark, but because in Tim Burton movies... The music, as we pointed out earlier, it tends to be done by a composer by Danny Elfman. It's usually usually compositions, usually orchestra, big sound, that kind of stuff. But he does pick songs every now and again. And that song I really liked way more than Dark Shadows, the movie. But what I liked about it is that song, there's a lot of beautiful melancholy going on through that Moody Blues song. And there's like kind of hints of darkness splashed through with these lighter shades, etc., etc. And I think that conjures for me the idea of a Tim Burton movie. So... wasn't surprised to see that song turn up in Dark Shadows. And again, don't worry about going to see the movie Dark Shadows. Instead, just keep listening to the Moody Blues. But that was soundtrack second selection for this week, Mark.
Kicking off now for What Your Kids Are Watching. This is a segment where we look at basically things that you might not have time or might not even be invited to see by your teenagers, the ones they're going off and seeing on their own. But it's always helpful to know because, in a sense, you really got to understand what they know, and then that way you can actually interact.
Or, Mark, perhaps teens are actually listening to our program and thinking, wow, what would I be watching right now? Let me listen to these gentlemen tell me all about it.
Let me tell you about your culture, teens.
Yeah, that's right. Let me tell you what you are watching.
Look, are you ready for another teen fiction that it to the big screen? I mean, have you had enough of the Twilight series?
Have I?
Could the Mortal Instruments get any longer? Is the Maze Runner going to provide you enough sequels in order to actually continue watching those books make it to the film? Or what about the Hunger Games? Can't we squeeze in another two or three? I know there were only three books in the original series.
I'm convinced we can.
Well, look, the Divergent trilogy is a huge blockbuster in terms of books. And it's made it to the cinemas. We've had Divergent, the film, and now we're ready for part two, Insurgent.
You found it. The future our people deserve.
What does Janine think is in that box, Caleb?
I don't know, but she's testing Divergence. Searching for the one who can open it.
Find them. Every last one of them.
Janine's never gonna stop coming after us. It's time we fight back.
We don't have the numbers.
We will.
I love this because it's such a collection of cliches. Like, honestly, there's a pity sometimes that you can't see, or maybe you can if you watch the video, what we're actually doing sometimes during these clips, because you can act them out. They're so angsty. They're so sort of teen-driven.
You're an angsty man, Mark. So Insurgents at cinemas this week. We dare say the kids, the youth, the teens, they'll be racing out to see this movie. Why?
Well, basically, it's built on three very, very popular teen books. So you've got Divergent, Insurgent, and then eventually we'll have Allegiant, which if...
Couldn't think of another Ent word. Good one.
I know. And if the movie industry actually follows this through, that will be in seven parts. But this is basically a story about a girl called Beatrice Pryor who lives in a world where, in order to sort of get rid of the damaging effects of individual will. People, when they come, I know, yes, when people come to, you know, a certain age, when they become 18, they have to choose between various factions that they're going to join. And these factions, which have sort of, you know...
Like Hogwarts, but for real.
Yes, kind of like that. Well, to be honest, they're kind of groovier sounding names, but they're all about, you know, their amity, abnegation, candor, dauntless. I honestly think that when they were writing this series, they thought, look, what are words that people don't know? But basically, all the brave people are in dauntless, and all of the honest people are in candor. Right.
So one character trait is allotted to one person per the rest of their life.
Yes.
This is in the near future, of course. It's a dystopian future.
It is. Yep. And if you live in this dystopian society, you can be brave but not selfless.
Of course.
Because if you were selfless, you would be in abnegation.
Yes.
So anyway, this is the way that this society posts some terrible Holocaust has organized itself so that in Chicago, so that we can actually all get along. And really, we don't get along, strangely, when we're all sort of put into boxes and said, you are this and I am that and never the twain shall meet. You know, and so what happens is Beatrice discovers that she is, in fact, an angsty hero heroine that she is, she discovers that she's actually all of them, not one.
Of course.
I choose all colours.
All right, so she's the Divergent.
She's the Divergent.
I see.
And
as a clip demonstrated to us in Insurgent, they've got to fight back against the oppressive empire that's trying to stop them from being who they are.
Yeah, that's true. And you've got it in a nutshell, and possibly the summary of every single teen angst film you've
ever seen. Yeah, I was just thinking that, because I actually haven't seen Divergent. I'm not necessarily rushing out to see Insurgent at cinemas, although I must admit to being more intrigued by the, as much as you said, it's cliche-ridden, and we can kind of set up the framework of these various teen blockbuster epics to make them all sound the same, because pretty much they do sound the same. Everything from Hunger Games to Maze Runner to The Giver are these movies about these near future dystopian kids rising up, evil empires, oppressive, etc., etc. But what I'm more intrigued by is the fact that the creator of this series has come up with an idea around individual character, and then how those characters are reflected, and then what you can look like when you're more of a whole person as opposed to an individual. It, to me, sounds like a much richer idea on screen. But is that true? You saw the first one.
Yeah, and I'm waiting for the second one with somewhat trepidation. Oh, no, look, I think it's probably going to be a great example of an action film for kids, okay? But and there's good and there's bad in this idea of having this sort of mixture of characteristics, because we want to say to people, look, we're Christians are all about a holistic existence. God's given you a whole range of gifts and several stages to your identity. If we just lived a physical life, if we were just in dauntless, if we were just brave people, you know, then we would miss out on the spirituality that is, in fact, an essential part of our character. So trying to live just a physical existence doesn't
work. Yeah, or missing everything from empathy to sadness to every other human emotion that God's given us to make us the people that we are.
The problem, though, is that these films tend to become vehicles for, you know, hyper-individuality. So basically, instead of actually saying, I want to actually include everybody, which is what the film seems to say on the surface, what it really does is it says, I have the freedom to be exactly what I want to be. I actually have the freedom to push off any form of boundary. And that's a bit of a problem, because, you know, we actually live in a world where total freedom doesn't work. I mean, we can't all be God. We can't all go around doing exactly what we want. That is, in fact, the recipe to chaos. That's the recipe to a dystopian future. That's not one we're actually going to get, you know, by trying to sort of embrace a film like Insurgent.
So that's what the kids are watching this week, Insurgents. It's in cinemas now. And also, what's in cinemas this week, to bring us up to the conclusion of our show as we focus on what's also around this week, there's a couple of films, other films to list off. There's a film called Run All Night, which I also cannot profess to being terribly interested in.
But Liam Neeson has made an entire career out of being an action hero.
How did that happen?
I don't know.
How did that happen? Taken was the reason why, but the most unlikely aging action hero, Liam Neeson, is in another aging action hero movie, Run All Night, where he plays, of course, a hitman who was in retirement, but he comes out, he's been forced to.
This is what happens to hitmen. I don't know what their retirement plan is, but they really should realize that they're all going to be forced to come back out.
One day you're going to get forced out because your estranged son is going to be killed by some mob boss. The most tantalizing thing about this movie, I think, is that Liam Neeson and Ed Harris are in this. Both great actors. I don't know why they picked this material, though. That's the cinemas this week. Also at cinemas is an animated film called Home from DreamWorks, the studio that's brought us everything from Shrek to the How to Train Your Dragon movies. It's about an alien coming to Earth and, you know, hilarity ensues because he meets a little girl and they bond and learn stuff about this world and the other world. I actually haven't seen it, but you did, Mark. Recommend it?
Ho-hum. Seriously, look, it's by the numbers. It's an animation by the numbers. It is not terribly offensive. You can probably sleep through it and your kids will wake you up with the end credits song.
But it does feature the voices of Steve Martin, that singer Rihanna, and then that guy from the Big Bang Theory.
Yeah, whose name always escapes me too.
Yeah, me too. So that's
I did the entire way through the film. I was going, oh, that's the guy from the Big Bang Theory.
Yeah, good. Yeah. That's what parents will be doing all the way through. So that's Home, an animated film out this week. Same with Run All Night. They're also in cinemas. What's coming up for you this week, Mark?
Well, let's take a look at what's going to be in the DVD shops or online. Who actually goes? Oh, gosh, I'm just thinking.
You mean the video store?
I was about to say, who actually goes to the video store anymore? And then I thought of all the people who support us who work in the video industry.
Just move on to what's being released quickly. In the home entertainment field.
Gallipoli's coming out this week on March 18. Now, we talked a little bit about this a couple of shows back, the television series for Channel 9, Gallipoli. I think well worth it. If you're actually looking for a gift for somebody who has a bent for history in your family, well worth looking at. Also, particularly thematically, full of themes of sacrifice, full of a generation. But again, if I would just highlight this, a generation that believed in God, and that doesn't come out as strongly as it possibly should in the series. But as for a beautifully made television, definitely worth seeing. Russell Crowe's The Water Diviner is also coming out to complete the sort of whole Anzac feeling.
Did you see it?
Yeah, Anzac legends are great things because they basically build our sense of character as to who we are as Australians.
Yeah, and he directed this and stars in it, didn't he? I heard it was really quite good.
Yeah, look, I actually think it was the big surprise, you know, because I'm not a big fan of there's a saying in my industry, our industry, everyone's industry, that only a fool directs himself.
Take that, Clint Eastwood.
But the problem is, you can't get outside of yourself often to see what often, it is you're
there's
doing
a few
wrong.
Occasions, yeah. Yes.
Not without
but that's what Rusty
syndrome.
Does here, and Rusty
and
goes
Rusty,
okay?
He does a really good job.
Good on him.
You know, and also the idea, too, of the enduring love of parenthood and how you never stop being a parent. You know, it reminds me very much of how God doesn't give up. You know, in a sense, of The Water Diviner is a brilliant prodigal son style story without the wayward son. Well, actually there is, but I don't want to give too much away. But there you've got the father not simply just, you know, running to see son, but searching and digging and finding till he finds him. And I think that's a brilliant story. Look, if you're looking in the small box this week, Network 10's got its 30th anniversary of Neighbours. Look, I say look out for that in the same way that I would say look out for that truck. Okay, just move to the left a little. Okay, also...
Bring back Mrs. Mangle.
Also, there's some big series returns, so Network 10 will be bringing back Bondi Rescue. That might be another truck to avoid. And there's no end to reality.
Is there something I should actually watch this week, Mark, on the small screen?
Yeah, look, it's not the launch of Gold Coast Cops.
It is
I'll
not,
give
no.
you that. But probably take a look at the ABC this Tuesday because you're going to have Making Australia Great, Inside Our Longest Boom, which is the beginning of a three-part series on what's actually happened to us as a nation. We found ourselves weirdly as one of the richest and most well-set economically nations on the planet. And strangely, we've got to ask ourselves, is that because we did the right things? And can we keep doing those right things and we'll just ride the wave forever? Or is it because of a series of things that were completely beyond our control? I think the series is worth watching, if only to understand that we just don't control as much as we think. And if you believe someone who says, I can make sure you have a prosperous future just by having this particular tax or this particular policy, yeah, well, more fool you. So generally speaking, that's what's coming up in the box this week.
Great, man. So that was this week. Now, looking forward to what's also around and what's coming up on the show next week.
Well, I'm say right out now, I'm really excited about talking to you next week about Cinderella. I know. I've got to say, I find myself in a complex position as a butch man because it is one of the best girls' films I've ever seen.
Yeah, I'm also going to be talking about Shaun the Sheep in the Big Picture episode that's remarkably family-friendly. Yet tune in, all ages, because there's going to be something for everybody. That's going to be the Big Picture next week. I'm Ben McKechin.
I'm still Mark Hadley. We'll see you next week.
The Big Picture is a Bible Society Australia production and part of Hope 103.2's family of podcasts and vodcasts.